Welcome to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld.
Season 2, Episode 25. A conversation with Oliver Körner von Gustorff, writer, curator, and former co-owner of the Gallery September in Berlin. Oliver contributes regularly to art magazines like Monopol magazine and the feuilletons of different newspapers in Germany. Recent articles include 30 years German unification, about the 80s and 90s in Berlin's music and art scene, of which he was a part, and Common Save the Arts, Plea for a Commons Culture. The conversation was recorded January 2, 2021.
Hello, Oliver. Very nice to talk to you.
Hi, Daniela.
Oliver, you are a writer. You are curating once in a while, and you were the co-founder of the now closed Gallery September in Berlin. For the recent issue of Monopol magazine, you wrote an essay about the Berlin art scene of the 80s and 90s. And this touched strongly also about your personal life. And we also will talk about this later because it is about you today and about your personal life and about art. So I want to know a bit more about you today and just in a nutshell, how your life in the art world started. What is your background? How did it happen that you became a part of the art world after growing up?
Yeah, well, I came to Berlin when I was like 18 and I fell in love with a member of an arts band performance group called the Deadly Doris, Die Tödliche Doris, which at the time in early in 19, I think they were founded in 80, were just starting to get well known. And there was this really exciting music scene at the time in Berlin with lots of bands and Einschütz und Neubauten, the filmmakers. And I, as a kid, was always interested in art. But when I came to, so I was, my, you know, I went to school. My parents were in the Kunstverein in Düsseldorf. They took us to museums. So I had a slight idea of what art could be. But what was happening in Berlin had nothing to do with my old idea of art. And there were, at the time also, these painters, like the neo-expressionistic painters were getting famous, were already famous, like Salome Fetting. Baselitz was already very well known, Lippertz. And this art scene I encountered was different. It was people who didn't want to be splattered with paint when they went out, or nobody really painted at the time. There were a lot of people who were performing, filmmaking, electronic music, noise, industrial kind of stuff. And before I came to Berlin, I was a civil servant in South Germany, and there was a music magazine called Sounds.
I remember that.
Yes, and they had one column by a guy, Alfred Hilsberg. He was doing a record label, and he was like kind of the John Peel for Germany.
Basically. Very important, Alfred Hilsberg.
Yes. Yes, and so I was reading this column. I think it was every 2 weeks it came out, and I, you know, and I was buying the records, and there was a record store in Berlin who was like sending records, or people bought them. And so I was like a real groupie. And the first night I came into this bar called Risiko, was a punk bar. There were all the people I knew from this column. Specifically, I was like, I thought really Gabi Delgado was hot from Duff. He was there.
And he was hot actually when he was young.
Yes, he was quite hot. And you know, Blixer and all those guys. And so I met Wolfgang Müller from Doris, and then there was like Nikolaus Utermöhn. He was sitting on a flipper. How do you call it? Flipper in English? Like a pinball. Pinball machine. He was pinball machine. Yes, he was sitting on there and watching me. And the funny thing was at the time I had been wearing glasses when I was going to school, and I was nearsighted. And then while I was dancing pogo, they just fell off my nose and were destroyed. So for several years, I was half blind. I couldn't really see.
So you felt more.
Yes, I was more like looking into emptiness or trying to be interesting or something. And this opened a whole new world to me. And at the time, I would say Cologne was really getting big, you know, like
you mean art-wise?
art-wise, yeah. And all the New York artists were coming over, and there was an international art scene in Cologne. People were wealthy. It was like West Germany. And Berlin, you have to imagine, it was like still in ruins. People didn't have telephones. A lot of people didn't have a proper bathroom. Most of us were living in the backyard, you know, and with coal heating, really, really poor and sexy, as our mayor called it later. Mm-hmm. And there were old galleries like Raab and Fahnemann, and who were also, Raab was also selling the new expressionist painters, but there was not a new exciting art scene in Berlin.
Wasn't it also that as much as there supposedly was a punk attitude with the expressionist painters from mm-hmm. Cologne and some of Berlin, mm-hmm. I feel that this music and art scene, not only in Berlin, it was also in Düsseldorf in the early 80s or late 70s. Yes. Mm-hmm. But that this was contrary, actually, to this idea of expressionist painting, or was
this? Yes, of expression, basically, of this one-to-one expression. You didn't want something like this kind of effective stuff. You didn't want to have mm-hmm. to express yourself with oil paint on a canvas. It was more about a universal concept and a universal idea of art. And really true, a lot of people who were important at the time were filmmakers. Mm-hmm. For instance, Heinz Emigholz was important.
And musicians.
Rotraud Pape, musicians, yes. And Berlin was, for music, Berlin was really like Cologne, but Berlin was very, very extreme at the time. There was like Mania D, Malaria, lots of really experimental bands. And so music was my entry into this art world that was just kind of preparing in the 80s. There was one gallery called Zwinger, who was interesting. And I remember there were lots of like off openings where you had like little shows with objects. And there was also End Art on the Oranienstraße, who were also like kind of expressive. But I thought a proper opening is always with dancing, you know, because people started to dance at the time. After an hour, you know, everybody was dancing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's not like this anymore.
Yes, but then I came to a regular gallery, I don't know which one it was, and there was a speech and nobody was dancing.
Probably we should go back to dancing.
Where's the dance and where's the fun? So I would say I was influenced by this kind of performative punk fluxus filmmaking kind of scene mm-hmm. a lot in the beginning.
I also remember that there was not so much the discussion about like quality, is it good or is it bad? It was more about like, just, you know, just do something, just make it yourself.
I wouldn't say it that way.
You wouldn't say it that way? Okay.
No, I think there was this attitude of being a dilettante or mm-hmm. like being autodidactic. That's true. But it was something different. Like you have like bad painting or something, like willingly doing something like in a trashy way. I think it was more rejecting the academic style, rejecting the institutions. And I think people were searching for some kind of a real quality in what they were doing, also when they were not conforming to the mainstream. And for me, for instance, like, you know, bands like Throbbing Gristle mm-hmm. or The Residents and all those groups still are really, really good. I think they really did a great job. There was also a lot of trash happening, but this was not the idea. This was also a big difference to Cologne. It wasn't so, it might have been cynical, the art music world in Berlin, but it wasn't ironic. And it wasn't what we really hated. The scene was really, really queer, I would say.
Yeah, I remember that's the first time that really queerness came out so openly. I remember so many gay artists, gay musicians, all these sort of like also camp stuff, which was really inspiring, I think, or it changed a lot, which we probably, is there any, do you think it is sort of like the root of what is happening today?
Yeah, I think like in the 80s and 90s, specifically in New York and Berlin, I think there was a big starting point for this idea of freedom or gender or whatever we have today. Today it's very problematic because we have these identity wars, but in Berlin, you know, I think when I came there, for me, I knew I was gay and I was like, this was a totally hedonistic and sexual time. But the important thing wasn't me being gay, it was music and art. And this was how we connected. This was, you know, you were connecting with different people. So the bars were mixed. You didn't know who was what. And people were experimenting a lot, even straight guys and girls. And it was kind of an attitude to be fluid. It didn't have to mean you were transitioning. It was like people didn't really want to know what they were. And yes. I also remember in the 80s, there wasn't this word transgender. And there were a lot of what you would call transgender stars in Berlin. There was like Jane County and Romy Haag and Zazie de Paris and Angie Stardust and lots of like little starlets. And I think a lot of them were like pop stars and prostitutes. And there was this kind of road where you had this like kind of trans prostitution mile. It was like really a bit like Walk on the Wild Side, and it was totally incorrect politically, if I look back, how you were calling people like transe. Mm-hmm. This meant like a transvestite or somebody
like tranny.
Tranny. Mm-hmm. And but it also included transgender woman specifically. And on the other hand, all these trans stars were not really famous for being in transition. They were famous, like Wayne County, for their act, for their, you know, or Romy Haag for the cabaret or yeah. whatever, for their art, we would say.
Yes, yes.
And so gender wasn't or sexual orientation wasn't the first identifier to meet somebody else, not at all.
You didn't mind so much. It just didn't matter so much. You just accepted who somebody was.
Oh, you just slept with everybody.
Yes.
You know, yeah. It didn't really matter. You didn't have this idea of also of success. I think this is what you might have meant in the beginning when you said people didn't care about quality. You didn't care so much about an education. You didn't care about if it's a commercial success, if you're well respected. This is part of the attitude I really liked in Berlin in this kind of wave, early wave movement. You did a lot of very intensive things which afforded a lot of love and work for one day or 10 seconds. I mean, everybody was arrogant like hell. Everybody, you just thought you were important in a star for being there. There were some ambitious people, but there were not so many. And it was more like this kind of, you really wanted to produce something for the sake of what you were doing, not to be a successful business person.
If I remember correctly, you also produced some artistic stuff. And how did then that transition happen that you suddenly thought like, oh, I can write about it or I can talk about it?
My boyfriend was a very important influence on me artistically. And I was like also really madly in love with him, very codependent. Mm-hmm. And being like this kind of modern artist with this kind of cool attitude was like the greatest thing for me.
Yeah.
And so I came from West Germany, you know, small town boy. And I just started doing art stuff to belong somehow. So I started organizing band nights, performances, stuff with other people. And then I had this friend, Oga. And we were also a bit into this off fashion thing, you know, mm-hmm. like producing our own clothes. And we had like, we were doing pink shirts with like, you just rub something, like you can take a newspaper. We were photaging Patty Hearst on pink shirts and embroidering them. And we had several shows in like off boutiques. And then we did performances. So in the like 88 or something, we applied at Künstlerhaus Britannien, which was like a project art space in Berlin, which was well known. And we got the studio and a grant. And this was like how I became an artist. And then we had like little galleries in West Germany, went to art fairs. I remember we went to the first Art Frankfurt. Mm-hmm. we had a very different attitude, because next to our, this was a gallery that was long forgotten from Karlsruhe. And next to our stand was Judy Lipke with Eigenart, and his first, I think it was his first art fair booth.
Wow.
And he had all this like kind of painting stuff. And Ogami, we did a video installation. There was a show in the cable, Sat.1 TV, and at midnight, people was stripping. Was like, you know, like you could just send in your video and take off your clothes, not stripping naked, but to the underpants.
I don't remember that, okay.
It was called Midnight Lingerie, Mitternachtspitzen or something. Like, oh, you know, wow. It was the beginning of this kind of way you had sex talk shows and people talking mm-hmm. about their sexuality. So we did a video with friends where we were always stripping to music. And I remember I was stripping to I Wanna Sex You Up. You remember this was like really a trashy, tacky song. And then and we did it like a perfume stand, and we developed a perfume, and it was called, and we made it out of old leaves, other perfumes, really like kids. And we called it Déjà Senti, which means like already smelled. And we had this like kind of like in a department store, we had this kind of presentation with a stripping video and little perfume bottles next to Judy Lipke. I had no idea about art market or anything. We were running after people, collectors, and spraying them with our perfume. Having this like kind of
the scent of success, yeah.
Yes, but it was more this like, you know, like this very, it wasn't faggy, but this camp attitude. And but I didn't really have an idea of art market or West German, you know, how big galleries or anything. Mm-hmm. So this didn't exist till the wall came down, on all the big galleries came over. There wasn't a really big art market in Berlin. So I was an artist. And then my boyfriend got really sick because he had HIV and, you know, AIDS. And it took him 6 years to die, and I had to take care of him. And this was also a very interesting time because also in the art scene, you know, like General Idea, ACT UP, also Judith Butler, 1990, wrote her Gender Trouble book. And this was when also in Berlin, the art scene became more interesting, I would say, you know, like a leftish queer art scene was forming. They were having performances and, you know, and activism groups and stuff like this. I couldn't really connect so much at the time because I was really busy working in a bar called Kumpelnest, which was a wild bar to make money to support my boyfriend. And I also missed this whole time in the early 90s when the wall came down and all the clubs opened in the East, because I was living in my bubble, and it was like an emergency bubble. You know, I had to go to hospital every 3 or 4 months, something happened. Like, it was terrible. Like, you could, any kind of like skin,
yeah,
internal disease, it was like really like The Exorcist, basically. And so my life was crumbling, and my old life was crumbling. And another thing was also very interesting for me was like I could see how precarious I was living, because, you know, other people were already having a life. I was nearly 30. I had been like going out and drinking. And also what was really obvious was everything I really loved, I did for free. You know, I was jobbing to finance my art, or however you want to call it, or the projects. So I was working in bars, and I never made a penny out of anything. I didn't start to write yet. I did something for Specs in the beginning, but not much.
Mm-hmm.
So to make it a bit shorter, my boyfriend died and my life was in shambles.
Yeah.
And because there was a certain rupture around this group he was playing in, the doors, they were like really, they had their issues with each other. There was nobody who was close to him who could do the catalog. There was a show,
mm-hmm.
like a little retrospective. So I, the first piece I wrote was basically a piece on the art of my dead boyfriend.
So that came from a very, very personal place that you, yes, did your first piece of writing.
Yes, but it was also important for me because I would say if he would have lived longer, he would have been a very, very well-known, important artist already in the mid-90s. You know, he was doing like conceptual painting, like R.H. Quaitman or something, mm-hmm. like with, you know, working with copies and repainting and reprinting and doing all this stuff. And I remember, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s in Berlin, there was this conceptual scene, Marius Barbias and Maria Eichhorn, mm-hmm. Thomas Wolfen, and they were people who were running around in like black Comme des Garçons clothes and making really minimalist things on the wall. Or today I would say like old fashioned serious concept art, poetic. And Nicky had done, he was working with William Blake images, found footage material, doing very colorful, multi-layered work. We don't have enough time to talk about it, but at the time people said, oh, this looks like it could be shown in a pizzeria or something, you know, because it didn't really fit into this kind of reduced, serious, I think you remember this time probably.
Absolutely.
Everybody was also talking not only about AIDS, but it was also about the systemic, how art functions systemic, what the role of the artist is. It was the time when, you know, the first art factories like Koons and Hearst and all those guys became yeah. big, and people were really, this was when people, everybody got into money. And
when was this transition, like after the fall of the wall?
No, it came with Reagan, basically, mm-hmm. in the 80s. I think it was just the rising of neoliberalism.
But also in Berlin?
Yes, because it's in Berlin where the wall came down, and then there was the chance to make money, to have businesses. And I think at the time, people were also dreaming of like industries coming to Berlin, which didn't happen. Because Berlin was starting, there was this exhibition in PS1, Wiesenbach, Children of Berlin. You know, people like Monica Bonvicini, who I think you also had in your podcast, they got famous. There was like Ewerk and Tresor, and then later Osgood and Bergman. So if I think about the 90s, early 90s, when the wall came down, what is forgotten very often is that the squatting culture in the old West Berlin, you know, like finding spaces to use and to explore, laid the foundation for this club culture mm-hmm. in East Berlin. So if you think about Osgood or Ewerk, or, you know, having clubs in old factories was kind of in the tradition of squatting or like reusing spaces. It was a bit like in New York in the early 70s, you know, when economy was down and people were just reusing urban space.
Were you a squatter?
Yes, but I was a squatter in West Germany in this like little town. It was very interesting. They wanted a cultural center or something like a project space. And squatters were basically in Berlin, I think in Hamburg a few, and in Freiburg in the south, and in this little town. And I was a guest because I was coming on holidays from my civil service in the hospital. And so at the day when I came, the police was kind of raiding the thing, and I was in the group on this. It was in the winter, I remember. I was in this group on the rooftop of this factory. It was totally icy, and we all got arrested, and we had to go to trial, and I went to prison for one night. And so in Berlin, I didn't squat, but I definitely was connected to the squatter scene. Mm-hmm. But you know, the scene in the 80s was also different from this. There was not this political, they were not taking sides. Everybody you never wanted to belong to a group or a movement, basically. This was one of the, you know, kind of arrogant, but it was very postmodern, basically. You never wanted to be identified mm-hmm. politically. I think the scene was very leftish, but not organized like in the squatter movement or Antifa or all those things. It wasn't as politicized openly as the people in Kreuzberg. And I also remember in West Berlin, there were leftist groups that kind of attacked. When you did a performance or something in Kreuzberg, there was a militant group that were also assaulting bars. There was this bar on Oranienstraße, Oranien Bar, which was one of the wave bar. And they attacked it because they thought it was decadent.
Mm.
Which was kind of
true, although you didn't have any money.
No, we didn't have any money, but we were kind of helping to gentrify the area mm-hmm. with our own little means. And so in the 90s, people were commercializing this, and Berlin got really famous as a club town, a city, but it took till 2004, I think, till Berghain opened up. But I didn't participate so much because this was exactly the time when my boyfriend was so sick. And I was working in this bar in West Berlin, so I wasn't really exploring the East. And I was just talking to a good friend, Mark Brandenburg, and we all experienced the coming down of the wall as a very ambivalent situation, because I remember the night when the people were crowding on the Kurfürstendamm. It was all about consumerism. It was about a national identity. Mm-hmm. And this was something we rejected also in the West. You know, it wasn't like something we wanted to embrace. Marx said, in looking back, we had a very arrogant view on the whole thing. But for us, it was like Walking Dead, you know, like it was like, it wasn't the freedom we had hoped for. And in the discussions in the end of the 80s, I think a lot of people thought about having a separate German, more leftish, more progressive country, not like a reunited Germany that's totally capitalistic. So we also didn't like the way how the capitalism explored the East, basically.
This leads almost to what we're experiencing now, that consumerism is valued over culture, but this is something I would like to address later. So yes, you wrote this essay for the catalog of your dead boyfriend, and yes, that was the first piece you wrote.
This was the first piece I wrote, and then there was this a friend of mine, Harald Fricke, who's unfortunately also died. He was a art editor of Taz, of this like leftist newspaper, and he asked me to do little pieces. And I remember how exciting this was, that you were writing something and then you could read it in the newspaper in a printed form. For me, it was like, oh, I'm in the newspaper. But then something funny happened. So I did a few of those, you know, portraits and reviews of art stuff. And one day I wanted to do a review of Bill Viola in the Deutsche Guggenheim, which was a joint venture between Deutsche Bank and the Guggenheim Museum.
So in the heart of capitalism.
In the heart of capitalism. And my editor, Harald, was, I think, dead already. Brigitte Werneburg, who's still working for Taz, she hated Bill Viola. And she said, it's kitsch, it's crap, we don't have to do it. And I said, yeah, but I really, really want to do it. And it was this show, I forgot the name, but it was a 9/11 artwork. And very, very dramatic, very pathetic. And I wrote a negative, but very well thought through review about the show. And a few days later, my telephone rings and it's Deutsche Bank, like the Body Snatchers. And at the time, they had a female director, Ariane Grigotheit, who has left a long time ago. And she was very flamboyant. She was a very fascinating person. She promoted some kind of a corporate feminism, which I couldn't really appreciate today. But she kind of discovered me. She thought this piece was not so great for them, but she thought it was really well written. And they asked to write something about Karin Sander, was my first piece. And I didn't, this was so funny, I didn't have any idea of minimalism. I had to write about Karin Sander.
Yeah, but how did you then get yourself into all of that stuff? Was it again that you just trusted completely your personal view, that you just said, yeah, I just write about what I can see and what I can feel without having this art historical background? Or how did you approach that?
You know, the interesting thing was, in the conversations with my boyfriend, Nikolaus, who was a very good, very conceptual artist, he read a lot of stuff. Without really recognizing it, he really taught me how to think and how to speak about art. Mm-hmm. And also, some of my friends were good artists. And I remember with Mark Brandenburg, we were both kind of autodidactic as artists, or me as a writer. And we were sitting at Burger King at Kurfürstendamm looking at a Keith Haring book. But you have to imagine, we're sitting in front of this book, Eight Ball, which was the last book Keith Haring did, kind of Picasso-ish, very personal. And we were discussing what it meant to us and how we see the painting, and very serious, you know, very innocent. Mm-hmm. And I think this was a very good approach to be look at things openly and personal.
So artists were your teachers?
Artists were my teachers, and I also read books, you know, like, you know, Virginia Woolf or whatever, all the time.
So language is also a teacher. I think language is so important. And I think perhaps it's really good that I started to study in Berlin, but I didn't end it, journalism and Germanistik. And today I'm missing out philosophy. So everything from, you know, the post-structural people, I knew from the Merve Verlag, which was like in the early 80s was the party place to go. They had the best parties, but I didn't really get deep into post-structuralism, and I was totally missing out Marx, Hegel, Engels, everything. So people who went to the university, they had more tools to debate politically about art. But I always read, for instance, when I was looking at Karin Sander, I was reading about minimalism.
Mm-hmm.
I found this very good book, Out of the Box. I don't know who wrote it, about land art and minimalism and all the whole movement. And at the same time, I was looking at, I remember I was quoting, I think, Stephen King or something. So I think this was the beginning of my writing, that because I was missing out this kind of mainstream art historical philosophy language, I had to use examples from films, pop culture, everyday life. And this is how I started to write. And Karin was very nice. I don't think it was one of my best pieces, but she really liked it. It got published. And then I started to work for Deutsche Bank and doing their website stuff and catalogs and stuff like this.
And how did that feel suddenly? How was that, the transition from being part of this kind of underground scene and then really working sort of like for this symbol of German capitalism?
You know, it was like a transformation. It was like a miracle because I was still working in bars. I had lost my boyfriend. I was living precarious, but you would really call it precarious today. And I remember this one day, there was an artist from New York, Holly Zausner, walking down the street. And I was cleaning a table in front of an Indian restaurant where I was working at the time. And she said, "What are you?" And I was at the same time, I was running like some kind of an off gallery with a friend. And she said, "What are you doing here?" And I was, you know, cleaning the table. "I'm just doing this for my insurance." And I was like really flushing red. And this was a very important point in my life. And then I quit working for restaurants and I got unemployed. And I had to go to,
the employment office, Arbeitsamt?
Yes, and also to a workshop where with other unemployed people, where they find out what you can do, and you have a coach and a motivator. And I was sitting in East Berlin with people who had diabetes and, you know, very, very, very special scene. It was around Christmas. And I could see suddenly that my artistic life, how precarious it was, you know, I could see the reality a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And the fun thing is, I started working for this online magazine for them, which at the time they did with Perlentaucher, which is a feuilleton service they have here online in Berlin, another online company, I would say. And they were negotiating the salary with me. And we just had left the Deutsche Mark and Euro. You know, Euro was twice as much as a Deutsche Mark at the time. You know, and I was living from 500 marks, which is nothing. Basically, it couldn't really. I was wearing like secondhand clothes and never traveled anywhere. So they said, "What do you want?" I said, "I have no idea. Tell me how much the job is." And they said, 3,000. And I was like, "What? 3,000? And then they said, "Euros." And I remember I really had to, I got like goosebumps. And I said, "Yeah, I do it. I would have, you know,
I'd do anything.
amputated my little finger for this amount of money." And so this was so much money for me because I had missed out the wealth that other people had amassed in the time. And I'd had no, you know, I'd lost contact to people with money.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I was in this art world, specifically Deutsche Bank. They were starting to support Fries in London. They were sponsoring the biennial in Venice. So suddenly from being a Kreuzberg kid, I was sitting there with like on the terrace of the Guggenheim with Russian oligarchs and art stars in Venice, you know, and I had no idea how wealthy people could be. And then you have this conversation at the dinner table, like about boarding schools of kids. So, and then they always said like, "And where are you from?" I said, "Look at me, what do you think where I'm from?"
Could you keep still this innocent beginner's look on the art, on the world, if you were writing about this? Are you still a witness, or are you a participant, or how is your relation now to this kind of art world?
Well, when I started to work for Deutsche Bank, I was really trying to please them, mm-hmm. you know, and in the corporate world, remember, like beginning of the 2000s, everybody wanted flash animations and their websites and online magazines, and everything was supposed to be really modern and online. And the difficulty with corporate art is that they wanted to be critical, or like it was also about globalization, a lot of the stuff. At the same time, you can't really tickle the issues, you know, you can't really have political discussions in a Deutsche Bank forum. That's, I mean, you could have it, it's easier today. But what I learned with Deutsche Bank was the style where you kind of say something radical, but it's not really, you can't really pin it down, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like, so if an artist deals with migration from North Africa and European borders, you write something poetical, critical, but you don't really make it too obvious. You would never say Europe is like a fort and people are drowning or whatever. Mm-hmm. You would really try to keep it in some kind of a diffuse place. And I think a lot of people in the 2000s were, this was when art criticism really went down the hill, and a lot of magazines were kind of describing more than criticizing. Mm-hmm. And for me, because I had been so poor, it was, in the beginning, it was really, it was a narcissistic reward to be part of this glamorous world, you know? So I was also kind of trying to feel like a good person, you know, write something of substance. And still I became a master in kind of lying, basically. And I remember the press trips I did to a lot of places, Miami, New York, wherever. It's fun in the art world, like the scene of the writers is like also like the super rich. There's like 20 people writing, 20 important people. And they got, at the time, that you got flown around the world, you know, mm-hmm. in first class hotels and BMW and whatever. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. German people working for big newspapers, they were wearing Dior suits, and art editors who were not so rich were complaining about the room is not good enough, or there's it's not designed enough, or they want a front view or something.
But that time is over.
Totally, thank God. But after several years, things got a bit weird with the bank, and I felt unhappy. This is when I founded the gallery, basically, as an antidote.
I wanted to ask you how that came about, yeah?
Yeah, I was so unhappy about my job. I still had these artist friends who were struggling, and I was making money. And I met this friend who inherited some money, and we thought it's time to, this was also very naive, we thought the place is important, you know, mm-hmm. proper lighting and a good buffet. So we opened this kind of space that was totally over the top. And the big fun thing about this gallery called September in the beginning was that everybody was guessing where we get the money from to provide free champagne, I think.
That was the idea of a gallery, to provide free champagne. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. This was, you know, I had this idea. I just opened the door and people want to buy art, because I was well connected in the art scene, mm-hmm. but nobody came, nobody bought the stuff. Then people started to buy a bit. And I was a lousy gallery owner, I think. I was good in curating. We had the best shows, I think, in town. We were very progressive. We also won little prizes in the Berlin Art Fair.
Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, yeah, we always had spectacular stands. And the crazy thing was, there was this group of galleries in Berlin who founded something like 7x7 or Sundays later, which went to London as a parallel art fair to Fries. And first they invited us and then they excluded me. I don't know why, still I have no idea. And this was also very funny. If you remember 2006, 7, 8, there was this time when everybody had a white cube and you had poetical work with like modernist vases and glass, and everybody was arranging their stand like a boutique, minimalist modernist boutique. Mm-hmm. Everything was very meaningful, and we had a kryptonite kind of neon yellow stand with like kind of a mix of industrial and folk art, which was like really like a. Oh, I remember how the other colleagues hated
it. I loved it, actually, because I really remember that stand. I came around the corner. I was on the same art fair. It was Art Forum Berlin. And I absolutely remember. It might even be that we first met there.
I think so. We met there. And then the funny thing was they have the special tours in the morning where they have the collectors going through and... several tours, and most of them are elderly women, and they hated the stand because when you were stepping into this first neon stand, your face turned green and you looked like the Wicked Witch from the North immediately when you were entering the place. And this was very funny because we got this prize, and this was when the art fair was heavily criticized for being too local, and there was this art director, Sabina, what was her name? And she was fired because there was this group of strong galleries, all the Neu and Neugeriemschneider and whoever was in this group, and they thought it should be more international and more, not so many trashy galleries. And so the next year we apply and we get admitted to this kind of newcomer section, Focus, and everybody in Focus hated us. God, suddenly, I don't know, not hated us, but we were kind of like in a classroom. We were like the freaks. And they put us next to the Sartrölsch, which was also a very interesting gallery, and the end of the corridor, where the whole structure stops and there's like a toilet or something. And we did our next stand, which was kind of a Dogville stand, which was like we collected, old carpets and rubble, and then we built a little like a gallery structure, like in Lars von Trier's Dogville film, just some walls and structures. And there was a new team, Eva Maria Häusler, like directors, Eva Maria Häusler, and I forgot the name of the guy, and they were walking by, I remember this, and an artist was working, Sandra Meisel, a woman artist, and they had a chit chat, and then Sandra said, I hope we get the prize again next year, and then Maria Häusler looks at her and says, you never get a prize twice, and then Sandra, she was really smart. She said, yeah, but you can win in football and soccer twice, mm-hmm. Which was totally right. I mean, it's not like you don't get your prize from a fairy, that thinks you're poor and should reward you. And this was a very interesting art fair because they wanted to be international. And there, in this Focus section, there was strong market galleries. And there was one gallery called Rodeo from Istanbul, which was at the time hot. There mm-hmm. were... like conceptual painting, political art. Looking back, we had really good work. We had Dorothy Iannona on our stand. Works today, they would be ripped off the wall. And people were just found it really interesting, but nobody bought this fantastic work that I saw on the Centre Pompidou last year in the collection.
Probably it was too early.
Yeah, it was a bit too early. So the time of the prize comes, and I just went out because I'm a narcissistic fairy, and I didn't want to take defeat. So I went out and had a cigarette, and suddenly some artist come from my gallery comes and says, hey, we won the prize again. So they separated the prize between this like kind of rodeo, this market gallery, and us for the presentation. So we got it a second time. And this was interesting in a political way because the first time people said, yeah, you got the prize because it's a Berlin art fair and mm-hmm. it's local. And this prize was given from a Mexican curator. I forgot all the names. But it was like supposed to be the first international art fair in Berlin. And we still got the second prize, which was like, this was like a great moment. And you got a flower bouquet from, from somebody from the government. And 3,000 euros.
Still after some time, you closed September?
Yes, because the art fairs were basically killing us. We were admitted to Art Basel Miami, and this was when my downfall began. And then I calculated, and I could see it would cost us 50,000 at least, or something, just traveling, transport, everything. This was my death penalty. And then I was still working for Deutsche Bank, and I was generating money from my writing PR jobs to finance the gallery. So I couldn't do anything properly. And this competition got really harsh. And it took me a year or two to find out how shitty the... It's just a shit job, gallerist. It wasn't...
Thank you.
No, but most people are sociopaths and assholes.
That's a whole other conversation. And we can really, at some point, really...
We should have it in private.
We really should talk about that.
For me, it was the wrong business. Mm-hmm. And then I did my thing as a project space. And then I moved somewhere else. And after 2 or 3 years, this was very funny. I also had a big drinking and drugging problem, like many people in the art world. I got sober. And I stopped my act, and I stopped living for a representation of a lifestyle. And I gave up, basically, and which was the right moment, because I paid everybody. I didn't go broke. I could continue to make money. You know, I know a lot of people who were running galleries who I don't know how they live today, probably from income support or little jobs. This didn't happen to me. I didn't, you know, I know a lot of artists who still get money from galleries that have been closed. So I didn't, I paid everybody, and I was able to end this in a proper way.
Yes, yes.
And if I look back, all the galleries, in the end, I was at Potsdamer Straße, I moved there. All the galleries, except of Tanja Leighton and Tanja Wagner, everybody closed, even the Sharks, you know, like Portico Lopez or Sommer Kohl, and you know, all the people I was thinking were doing much better than I did, because I was like not a very good business person, and I didn't really make connections to institutions, and I'm a freak, you know. When on art fairs, there was this guy Guido Westerwelle, a famous politician, was coming. I was running away. I hid. I'm also a sociopath. I hated all the collectors and this kind of...
Then it was just not the right job for you.
No, totally not. Totally not. Because I was like, I love to curate the shows, but I really hated the role of the salesman. This was not for me. I think everything is personal. I couldn't separate it.
That's what I hear through the whole story, that everything you're doing is very, very related to you as a person, which I find is great, actually. No, I think what
can also be a problem.
It can be a problem, but you know, it can be also a big chance. It can make you something singular, you know, because you're really coming from your own place. So this is where I want to sort of like go more into recent times to get your thing together, to get sober, you know, to do all of these things that also takes a lot of power and courage. And you're still part of the art world, although in a different function. So what is your personal relationship with art and artists right now? What role does it play in your daily life right now? And if you write a piece, like, for example, I mean, this piece you were just wrote for Monopole, this is related to your personal life and to the artists you know personally and who are or were your friends. But you also wrote something about the Andy Warhol show at Museum Ludwig, which is probably from a different point of view personal, because you couldn't have known him personally. You were not part of that scene. So how do you approach that now? Because you're not in Berlin at the moment. You are in your little castle in the countryside. Yeah. And how do you approach all what you're doing right now?
It's a very broad question. Let's say getting sober is, I think, a good thing to do. And I don't mean just alcoholism or whatever. I think also therapy, getting more clear what you're all about. And I know a lot of people in my generation who also open galleries, who grew up the same way I grew up in, the, you know, in this kind of very materialistic Western traumatized culture, still affected by World War II. Specifically in Germany, with Nazi Germany, you know, our parents were kind of, my parents were refugees, and dealing with all this kind of expectations shit. And for me, it was a very important step to feel okay about myself, not in a narcissistic way, but to trust my intuition and to trust that I also, as a spectator, would be able to understand art. And a long time, specifically when I was having the gallery, when you remember the galleries, the whole discourse, with globalization and later with also now gender, became very specific. It started in the 90s with the institutional critique, which developed a language that normal people can't take part in, you know, you don't understand it. And we have an academic cast in the institutions, also in the magazines, that can use language as a weapon to mark their domain and to keep people out of the discussion. And this is also a very big part of my work. I really try to write in a way where I don't oversimplify, where I share my experience, but in an understandable way. I try to find images, or if there's something philosophical or political to explain, I try to find a way to grasp it for the normal reader in a good language. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like more from a poetic position, or the position of literature or storytelling, but still getting to the point, you know, not writing stuff that's like a perfume. Mm-hmm. And I think what I feel right now, we're all in this struggle, in this power struggle regarding gender, race, class, inequality, whatever. We all know what I'm talking about. And my part in society is, I wish I would be more of an activist or join a party. Perhaps I can do all this, but my job is to write. Mm-hmm. And art basically is a very interesting field because it's connected to the reigning class, to the bourgeoisie, and it's also dealing with a lot of topics that are seen as problematic. Migration, climate change, all this stuff is like substance for art. So my job is to think about this, share my experience, and to make the debates more approachable. And I think because I'm like an old hag, I'm not disrespectful about people who are academics, but I think we have to find a level where you stand in front of a work and you can communicate about it. The whole discourse shouldn't be so exclusive. And it's also a lot of bigotry in it. Bigotry, mm-hmm. because the British say you can't have the cake and eat it. You can't be part of the system that destroys the world and criticize the system at the same time. That's a big problem for a lot of people right now. And the important insight I have, I think we have to start where we are, as imperfect, as broken me specifically. You know, I work for a corporation. And this is, I think, a big advantage. I had this, you know, off subcultural precarious life, and I also had this other life where, you know, we have this kind of privileged bubble art world life. And I think because I have both experiences, also I suffered a lot from both, you know, and I also enjoyed both a lot, I have much to share, and perhaps sometimes much more than people who have always been in this kind of mainstream academic artistic thing, and that I still identify with this like kind of system that's broken so much. And I think I don't want to look at the system full of hate. I also feel sorry for people, or there's a lot of good stuff still happening, but we have to admit it's broken. I think we have to start to debate on this basis that we don't, you know, a lot of people still see the art world as a safe haven. Mm-hmm. This could be true in an economic way, there will always be a market, there will always be rich people, and there will always be art for rich people. But this whole discursive human bubble is exploding. It doesn't work anymore. We can see this through the pandemic, that there's no social encounters on art fairs anymore. And you can see that art doesn't really have to contribute so much to what's happening right now. But there's also a lot of people seeing this problem. So there's a lot of other project initiatives starting. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting time. And I don't know where I'm going right now. But I don't believe in being authentic. You know, I don't think there's a true self that has to be discovered. But I think there's something like an honesty we all have, you know, just mm-hmm. to say where we are right now. I think identity, to get back to this identity issue, is something that's floating, changing.
Yeah, I find it very interesting what you said, that we have to start yeah. where we are. And that not only the art system, but we see through the pandemic right now that the system itself is broken. And we are broken in it also as people, because we are not a unity. We are made up from so many different parts, which, you know, are mirrored in our, what we do in our everyday life. And so we can be sort of leftish and at the same time earn a lot of money. We can have so many identities. And you speak in your podcast for Monopole about the wall exhibition. There was one thing you said about that we have to just live with this complexity. We just have to live with that everything is happening at the same time. So that would be my last question now, would be, how would you like us all to approach this complex issues we are facing right now?
I would say basically it's too simple right now. We live in a binary world, you know, through the internet, through digitalization. We have a culture online, for instance. You only have two possibilities, thumb up and thumb down, like or not like. And you can see this in the US, like it's partisanship and it's divided countries, and it's left and right and good and bad, and you know, and also this, the debates about gender or race, black and white. And I think we are heading for a new era in human history, and what we are experiencing right now is this clinging to a binary way of thinking. Because everything is so complex and insecure, we want easy, simple solutions because we're frightened and we want to be on the right side. And we have to give this up. And we have to live with our contradictions, which doesn't mean we have to be stuck in them forever. I don't think it's possible to be leftish and exploit other people at the same time. We have to get away from this in a longer term. But to do this, we have to first see that we are not standing on the right side. And this is a very big issue about the art system. You know, specifically the market system, it's doing the most corrupt and unbelievable things, working without any moral, at the same time to justify this kind of behavior that's still going on. Galleries, curators, everybody, including me, we all try to present ourselves as empathic human beings. And we have to see this contradiction in a longer term. And I don't say this like brimstone and fire, you know, I don't want to say, oh, damn you all. But I think slowly in baby steps, we have to also change as a society that's so clear economical, you know, and the art system is just like a prisma for the whole society. And the interesting thing is in the art system that we still have a connection to this 1%. There's a lot of power, social power also amassed in the art system. So I think the debates there could also, even if it's like just a few people, they could change a part of the society in a longer term. But we have to give up the idea that we are on the right side, that we're the good ones.
So I have to pose another question.
Yeah.
You're addressing the art system. But the art system is not necessarily what art can mean in a society. So how do you think art and artists can, again, claim these essential necessity for a functioning society? Do you think they have this essential necessity? And if yes, why do you think so?
I wrote already something about it. I think this there's this idea of founding commons, you know, art commons. Mm-hmm. And also there's this idea of, there's this leftish art newspaper I also wrote a piece in called Arts of the Working Class. And there's this idea of to form unions or something. So I think people are already working on different models of organizing or coming together and forming something new. You know, we all can wish for change and we all can see what's going on, but basically we have to change the way how we interact, also economically, practically, everything in a longer term. And personally, you know, and I'm sitting here in my little Laura Ashley home and you're ready to go to a nice lunch with collectors, I don't think we have to lose everything, but we have to let loose of all this a bit more and think of, sounds corny, think of others more. Not so much about ourselves, yes. But this is a very cheesy message for the last sentence.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, okay. Dear Oliver.
Daniela.
For more information on Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast, follow us on Instagram at Voices on Art and at van_horn_Düsseldorf. There you can also leave a comment. Visit our website van-horn.net and subscribe to Voices on Art on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the platform of your choice. If you want to, leave us a 5-star rating. Thank you for listening to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Stay tuned and connect.